is, Diane, on my mind, the future of abortion in the United States. This summer, the Supreme Court is set to rule on an abortion case that could weaken or even overturn Roe v. Wade. With the court's conservative majority, most experts believe this decision could mark the end of a woman's constitutional right to abortion. My guest today is journalist Jessica Bruder, author of the book Nomadland, which was made into the Oscar-winning film of the same name. She's written a new cover story for The Atlantic titled The Abortion Underground. In it, she examines the history of abortion access in the U.S. and the networks which have worked to ensure women have the tools they need to safely terminate a pregnancy. She says this underground is now growing in preparation for a post-Roe America. Jessica, talk if you would about the case before the Supreme Court now in regard to abortion.
The case you're talking about is Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, and a decision is expected by late June. The Supreme Court is looking at a Mississippi law. That law bans nearly all abortions beyond 15 weeks of pregnancy. The reason they're looking at it is it's a direct challenge to Roe and to a follow-on decision to Roe, which is Planned Parenthood versus Casey that came nearly two decades after Roe. Between those two decisions, the court has held that states can ban abortion, but only past the point of fetal viability. The court in Casey found that that's about 23 to 24 weeks of pregnancy. The exception, of course, is when the mother's health or life is threatened, and that's you can't ban abortion in that case. But prior to that point, the court says you can't impose an undue burden on a woman's right to abortion. So that's where we are now. So if the Mississippi law is upheld by the court's 6-3 conservative majority, that would in essence nullify Roe's recognition of the constitutional right to an abortion pre-viability.
And already we've got the Oklahoma state legislature moving toward exactly that kind of action.
Absolutely. That's an outright ban on abortion, is what you're referring to in Oklahoma. And any provider of abortions who were found violating the law would be in jeopardy of a $100,000 fine and 10 years in prison. That would be the most restrictive law in the country. But there are about 13 states now that have what are called trigger bans. And those are essentially spring-loaded bans that will take effect the moment the Supreme Court allows them to, if they do. So if Roe versus Wade is overturned, we've got 13 states with bans that are just ready to go.
Your article focuses primarily on what women did even before Roe v. Wade was passed and what some individuals and organizations may do if the Supreme Court does rule in Mississippi's favor. Can you talk a little about the history? For example, you start your piece with a contraption called a Del M. Tell me what that was all about.
In the years before Roe versus Wade, when abortion was still illegal, women were looking for a way to take it into their own hands. And for some women in California, for one women's group, that meant shadowing an illegal abortionist when he was working in his clinic. This guy was named Harvey Carman, and he invented something that is now a medical standard. It's called the Carman cannula, and it's a flexible plastic straw used in a suction abortion. So one of the women in this group took his technology and adapted it into a device that would be easy for anyone to build, that they called a Del-M. That device started with a needleless syringe that created suction, continued with aquarium tubing, had a holding tank of sorts that was a small mason jar and terminated in that cannula. And Lorraine Rothman and Carol Downer toured the country, calling themselves the West Coast Sisters, these two activists teaching women to learn more about their bodies and also how to do what they called menstrual extraction, which was what they called the procedure they did with Adele M. The idea was, for plausible deniability, that one could just extract the menstrual period as a way of finishing it all at once. So this wasn't necessarily an abortion device. It wasn't promoted that way, but it was capable of performing a first trimester abortion, an early first trimester abortion.
And what you're pointing to is the fact that now, in anticipation of what could happen, not only at Supreme Court, but other states down the line, women are preparing themselves now to learn various techniques to make sure they can have an abortion, even though it would be considered illegal.
Yeah, unbeknownst to me, there's always been a network in America of what they currently refer to themselves as community providers, which means people providing reproductive health care and sometimes abortions outside the traditional medical system.
And who are these women?
Some of them are midwives, some of them are doulas, some of them are sex educators, some of them are activists. They could be doing anything from helping mail abortion pills to people in restrictive states, to teaching people how to build and use Adele M, or a commercially produced manual vacuum aspiration device, which is essentially the modern mass-produced version of the Adele M that's in widespread use today.
And how widespread is this, if I can call it a network of women?
Well, it's hard to tell exactly because it's very word-of-mouth, whisper networky, and clandestine by design. One woman I spoke with said there were probably about 50 people in her immediate network, but probably thousands if you went wider. So again, I think some of the people are talking to each other mostly on a need-to-know basis, and it's hard to tell because these are not people who are prepared to stand up and be counted, particularly if what they're doing becomes increasingly criminalized. But there are more people who are concerned that Roe could be overturned and that women will be left stranded, particularly women who can't travel. In fact, there's even a group in Mexico that is seeking to provide abortion pills to women, either people who come over the border or possibly bringing them into the States.
Were you able to talk with any of these women?
Absolutely. It did take some time. This is the kind of reporting that can really only be done slowly, in that you spend a lot of time talking to people before they feel comfortable sharing information with you. They want to know that you're committed to learning the whole story, that you're not going to sensationalize them, and they want to know that you're not going to out them. So it took quite a while, but yes, I was able to speak with a bunch of people.
And how do they regard themselves? Do they see themselves involved in kind of a calling to provide services for women that would otherwise be denied? Do they see themselves as outlaws?
One of the first people I spoke with told me that the way she sees it, reproductive rights aren't something that are given to us by the state. And they're not something that's given to us by the church. They're something that we have inherently. So people need to be able to access them. And that seemed to be a feeling that was shared among just everybody I spoke with. They believed that people needed to know more about their own bodies, that abortion is one of many things that people should be able to do autonomously if necessary. And many of them felt that even if that meant breaking the law, preserving that right was the most important thing.
You know, as of now, at least with the Planned Parenthood facilities remaining opened around the country, there are all these protests. I would think it would be ghastly to confront that when you yourself are in need to have to face an angry, threatening crowd.
Yeah, and I think that's one reason some people, if possible, would rather avoid clinics altogether, frankly. But there are volunteers all over the country called clinic escorts, and it's their mission to escort people safely to the clinic, even if that means getting them past a group of really angry people. But it's interesting because there are so many things other than clinic protesters that make it hard for people to access abortion already. We've been talking a lot about the possibility of a post-Roe future, but when you talk to people who are doing this sort of work on the ground, what you hear is that future in so many parts of the country has already arrived. 90% of counties in the U.S. don't have a clinic. Abortions aren't eligible for federal Medicaid funding under the Hyde Amendment. A lot of people have to drive quite a long way. Some of them in some states may have to make up to 3 visits around it. So for some people, paying for transportation, lodging, taking time off from work, there are so many restrictions that it's become quite onerous and put abortion out of reach for some people.
Now, what about the cost involved?
Yeah, for an in-clinic abortion, early first trimester could be around $500 beyond when more complicated procedures are needed. That could be at $1,000 or more. People who are doing basically accessing the pill via telemedicine online, so that's not an in-clinic abortion. When I went and bought pills just to see how it worked, I paid about $150 for those pills.
You paid $150 for the abortion pills, but as I understand it, as time moves on, even the purchase of those pills could be in danger, whether in person or by mail. Talk about what's going on with pills.
For a lot of people, pills seem like the most likely fallback option for many people if Roe falls. But the states have been pushing back against that, restriction-heavy states, for quite a while. Texas, for example, has already made it a felony to provide abortion pills through the mail and has created more restrictions on doctors who seek to prescribe them to patients. There are 19 states that prohibit the pills from being prescribed by telemedicine or delivered through the mail. And there are 9 states that are trying to do the same right now.
And is telemedicine the way that many women obtain those abortion pills?
Absolutely. And that's something that's relatively new that came with the pandemic. Prior to the pandemic, a patient had to go to a doctor to receive the pills in person. And when COVID made that particularly difficult, that regulation was temporarily suspended. It was later reinstated by the Supreme Court, but more recently, it was just pretty much canceled altogether. So now on a federal level, telemedicine is legal, which doesn't prevent individual states, however, from banning it.
It's so interesting, I must say, because in your piece, you trace the history of abortion in the U.S., and you say it wasn't always so controversial. What happened? How did it work back then?
Well, it's interesting. Back then, there was a completely different idea about, many things, but just science hadn't progressed to where it is now. And the U.S. in the very beginning was pretty much still using British common law. And that was the only law that even dealt with abortion at all. So basically, it didn't recognize the existence of a fetus until after what was called the quickening, which sounds like the name of a sci-fi movie or something. But the quickening is the moment that a woman first feels the fetus moving around. So the first time the kick comes, which is interesting because that's something that would have to be reported by the woman herself. And there was really no other way to prove a pregnancy. Absolutely. We didn't have dollar store pregnancy tests. There just wasn't a way to do it.
At what point does that quickening ordinarily occur?
In the second trimester.
Second trimester.
Yeah. Prior to that, even if somebody thought she might be pregnant, there wasn't any way to confirm it. And it was legal for women to seek relief from what was considered an obstructed menses. Basically, there was this idea that your flow was blocked somehow. And patients could solicit treatments from midwives. And there were even many home health manuals that gave recipes, sometimes, you know, concoctions with herbs. People have been using since antiquity to induce miscarriages.
Did those herbs actually work?
Some of them, yes. We know, for example, that even during times of slavery, enslaved women used cotton root bark to induce abortions. Talk about subverting the power structure, given that that is the cash crop that they are enslaved to, you know, help produce. So sometimes, yes, it's just a matter of knowing, I believe, that just because something is natural doesn't mean it's not a toxin. So while these things can work, they can also cause other challenges and damage if not used correctly with somebody who really knows what they're doing.
What about this device you talked about earlier that women used, the Del M? Is that danger-free?
Well, first, let me tell you, absolutely nothing is danger-free, and I'm not a doctor.
Exactly.
but let me tell you what I did learn. So the Del M is essentially the predecessor of what doctors are still using today, which is a manual vacuum aspiration kit that's used for a procedural abortion. The idea is you draw back on the plunger of a needleless syringe to create suction, and then you've got Carmen's cannula, which was, you know, debuted in illegal abortion clinics, and that is what is actually inserted. It also involves a one-way valve, which was first used on the Del M. So the Del M is kind of part of this timeline. And there haven't been any studies, to the best of my knowledge, done exactly with the Del M. But what we do know, and I spoke with Dr. Paul Blumenthal, he's a professor emeritus of obstetrics and gynecology at Stanford, also a practitioner and a researcher. And what he told me is in South and Southeast Asia, lay people have been successfully trained in performing manual vacuum aspiration for a very long time. He said that this actually is not an incredibly complicated procedure, so that people really could be trained to do it, lay people.
If a woman wanted to perform an abortion on herself using this device, is that possible?
No, she couldn't do it herself. She would definitely need help unless she was very flexible. So when Lorraine Rothman and Carol Downer were training people to do this in the early 70s as part of something called the self-help movement, they were training people in feminist groups. And the idea was that small circles of people who knew each other should be prepared to provide this care for each other. So they would know each other, they would know their bodies, and they would be doing it in a group. Essentially a mutual aid group where, you know, somebody would insert the cannula, somebody would be there speaking with the patient, making sure she's fine. You would just have a whole group of people. And when it came to the procedure, it would actually be the patient herself that was withdrawing the plunger on the syringe to control the actual suction. So it was definitely considered something that should be done by well-trained groups of people who know each other and know the procedure.
Now a quick break. When we return, the rest of my conversation with Jessica Bruder.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here is the rest of my conversation with journalist Jessica Bruder. Her cover story in this month's Atlantic looks at the future of abortion in America. We talked earlier about when abortion was acceptable, or at least not so controversial. When did that cutoff point occur? When did abortion become something that doctors refused to do, that laws came into being? How did all that happen?
Well, the earliest restrictions we know of in the U.S. on abortion were pretty much poison control measures. You and I already talked about how people could consume dangerous toxins to try to terminate a pregnancy. But what was happening is by mid-century, newspapers in the U.S. were full of all these advertisements for patent medicines with these kind of wild names, from Madame Drunette's lunar pills to Dr. Vandenberg's female renovating pills. But some of these preparations were dangerous. Some of them could be lethal. So the first abortion laws were really aimed at regulating those products. They weren't taking a stance against abortion per se, but it was a public health matter. And that started to change around the time that the American Medical Association was founded in 1847. And one of their first campaigns was lobbying against abortion. Now, ostensibly, this was on moral grounds. And also, it was overtly on nativist grounds. The idea was that, oh my gosh, we now know that Anglo-Saxon middle and upper class Protestant women are getting abortions. And if they do that, there won't be enough of them to outnumber the newcomers to America. I mean, somebody leading the campaign for the AMA, Horatio Storer, actually talked about how the future rested on the loins of these women. So I do believe there was a fair amount of xenophobia that was pretty explicit. But also, there was an effort to push out midwives and traditional healers, who were pretty traditionally abortion care providers. They were familiar providers. So by pushing them out and tossing them to the margins, this could be part of the effort of physicians to assert themselves and their profession and to kind of regularize it and to gain prominence. And it pretty much worked. By the end of the 19th century, there were laws in every state criminalizing abortion.
So how did abortion eventually begin to tilt toward legalization? What was going on?
Yeah, so the women's rights movement began gaining momentum. And suddenly, you know, doctors, lawyers, and public health advocates are starting to lobby for abortion law reform. Meanwhile, we've got activists who are tired of waiting for change, who think that it's great that those mainstream efforts are happening, but that thinking that women need this now. So people took matters into their own hands. It's fascinating to me that there was something called the Clergy Consultation Service. This was about 1,400 Protestant ministers with a smattering of rabbis and Catholic priests, and they connected tons of women with abortion providers.
Huh.
There was the very well-known Jane Collective, who took it upon themselves to learn how to perform abortions, and by some estimates may have performed up to 12,000 of them. There's a group called the Army of Three, some California activists, and they traveled around the country holding workshops and distributing lists of well-vetted abortion providers, usually overseas. So a lot of people were doing this underground work, and essentially what I came to think as I learned more was that the underground never entirely went away.
And is now on the rise.
Yes.
sensibly.
Yeah, people are concerned. It's interesting. It never totally went away. And you kind of see that when that device we were talking about, the Dell M, pops up in popular culture. I was going through all the news stories from, you know, the period of just before Roe versus Wade till now that mentioned the Dell M. And it seems like whenever reproductive rights and Roe came under threat, suddenly people are talking about the Dell M again. So this was handed from generation to generation and never totally disappeared, because I think people always realized that the recognition of abortion as a constitutional right could be undone by some Supreme Court in the future.
And do you believe that the law will find ways to crack down on those who are operating underground?
That's a great question. I do believe that laws will be enacted for that purpose, but with certain things, for example, mailing pills, given that the mail is a federal service and that pills are federally legal, it's kind of hard to imagine how successful states might be trying to put that genie back in the bottle, because pills are small, they're discreet, they're very effective, and medically as safe as Viagra. They send fewer people to the ER. So it's really hard for me to see how they would get that contained. And when we talk about the abortion pill, people usually are referring to a two drug regimen, which is mifepristone, followed 1 to 2 days later by misoprostol. And misoprostol, however, can also be used alone to induce an abortion. And to get that, one could walk across the border into Mexico and buy over-the-counter a drug known as Cytotec, which is the trade name for misoprostol, and it's used for treating stomach ulcers. It also has veterinary uses. So this is a drug that's around and it's really cheap. So it's hard to see how that's something that access could be curtailed to.
But didn't a mother get in trouble for buying these medications for her young daughter?
Absolutely. So while I think it will be hard for states to curtail the mailing and purchase of pills, that doesn't mean there aren't pitfalls for people who would seek to use them. So the case you're talking about involves a mother named Jennifer Whalen, who bought pills online for her 16-year-old daughter. And she bought them basically on the gray market. In terms of what we know, the pills were good, but she did not get them via telemedicine with a prescription. We know all that stuff does push up the price and makes things less accessible to people sometimes. So she was in Pennsylvania. She bought them online for her daughter, who was 16 years old and pregnant and didn't want to be. And when the teenager took the pills, the miscarriage began. And, you know, nobody would take these pills recreationally, because a miscarriage is not fun. There's bleeding, there's heavy cramping, and it frightened her. And they went to the emergency room. And when Whalen told the doctors about the pills, even though the daughter was absolutely fine, Whalen ended up getting criminally charged. She pled guilty to offering medical advice without a license and was sentenced to 9 to 18 months.
Pennsylvania is one of those states where what? What are the rules about using these pills or about abortion generally?
Well, the challenge really isn't even always what the rules are. It's how the rules can be applied. Because the idea that Whalen was offering medical advice without a license seems a little strange, right? We don't think that law was really intended to target self-managed abortion. And in fact, self-managed abortion has been criminally investigated in about 22 states, and in many places, laws that weren't intended to have anything to do with abortion. Laws from abuse of a corpse to murder have been applied, and people have gotten in trouble because prosecutors got pretty creative.
So, Jessica, my daughter and son-in-law are both physicians in Boston. Both got their MDs at BU, and never once were taught how to perform an abortion.
That's a huge issue, and one I didn't have space for in the story, but there's just not enough education around it. A lot of people who are training to be doctors just don't receive that sort of training. And there are definitely people advocating for more of it, and also advocating that some of these procedures, for example, manual vacuum aspiration, can be very competently performed by nurse practitioners and clinicians. And, so there's an argument to widen the pool of people who can do it, and also to just go deeper with our existing medical pool, many of whom don't get trained in how to do this.
So, looking ahead, what are the estimates for the health of women should repealing Roe actually happen?
Well, there aren't very hard estimates on that. We do know, however, that 26 states will either ban or try to ban abortion. And because childbirth is actually more dangerous than abortion, we can expect more maternal deaths. How many? I couldn't begin to tell you that. But when it's hard for people to access abortion, often they end up getting it further in a pregnancy, and it's a harder procedure.
Many, many, many years ago, a dear friend of mine, she used the horrible coat hanger and almost bled to death. And that's what frightens me for women who may not know that there are people out there who can help. But how in the world are they going to find them? Whom can they trust?
Well, I can give you one place they can go, and it's a place that is available online, but is not based in the U.S. That's Aid Access. It was started by Dutch physician Rebecca Gompertz. She had made news before for starting something called Women on Waves, basically an organization that would take boats to nations where abortion was illegal and then pick up women and give them abortion pills in international waters. That was Women on Waves. So now she also is running something called Aid Access, which women can go to their website, they can be prescribed abortion pills. Even if you're not pregnant, you can be prescribed such pills for advanced provision. I actually went online and did that to see how the process works. And if you're somewhere in the U.S. where they're available legally by mail, they'll come locally. But if not, they also partner with a pharmacy in India. So that's one thing people are doing. There's also all sorts of people out there who are willing to educate others about self-managed abortion. There's a group called Self-Managed Abortion Safe and Supported. There are abortion and miscarriage help hotlines. There are people who are often willing to talk about it, and it is legal to educate other people in most cases. So that's there. And again, we know that pills are legal. They are beyond legal. They are approved by the FDA for up to 10 weeks gestation. They're approved and have protocols with the World Health Organization for up to 12 weeks and even in some cases beyond. So at the end of the day, I think a lot of this is going to be about information, right? And that basically people having the knowledge that they don't have to resort to these methods that are dangerous. I wrote a book called Nomadland that was essentially about people finding a sort of mutual aid and support structure that they could create outside a system that had failed them. This is a parallel situation. It's people coming together, providing mutual aid, showing solidarity when a system is failing or may be about to fail.
So in the end, doing away with the right to abortion could backfire.
I don't see how they can stop the fact that more autonomy is coming for women with abortion, regardless of what the court does. we aren't in the same days that we were before Roe. We have pharmaceuticals. We have different ways of conveying information. We've got the internet. So women, even without those tools at hand, have always found ways to procure abortions. And with those tools, I can't see how anybody could manage to stop it.
Jessica Bruder, I want to thank you so much for being with us. You've done a true service to women by writing this article and being here with me today. Thank you so much.
It's an honor to be here with you, Diane. Thank you.
That was Jessica Bruder. Her cover story about the future of abortion in America appears in this month's Atlantic. And that's all for today. We welcome your feedback and suggestions. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody. Our engineer today is Michael Kidd. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.